Welcome to the intersection of theater and even more theater. You have achieved stage grok. Stage Grok, the roaming theater podcast, coming to you from the geographic center of the American Theater. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Today, I'm talking on the phone with Peter Felicia, writer and musical theater historian from his home in New York.
Okay, well, thanks for talking to me today. The biggest reason I wanted to talk to you is that I think you're the only person I know who loves musicals more than me. And you've written more books than me, and you're quite the musical
freak. Is that true?
I think so, yeah.
But let's not think about quantity. Let's think about quality. Your books are sensational.
Well, thank you very much. I'm in the middle of your newest book, The Great Parade.
Any good?
Love it. I love all your books.
Oh, good.
But what's particularly cool for me is, first of all, I was born during that 63-64 season, so it's kind of cool. And
let
second,
your youth be a consolation.
Yeah.
Go on.
And I've always thought of that moment as a real pivot point. And I guess for me, it's always been about Anyone Can Whistle and Fiddler and Dolly.
Sure.
But talk a little bit about why you wanted to write a whole book about this one season.
It really did change after this, and I think the Kennedy assassination had a great deal to do with it, because the mood of the country was really dynamic as a result of that happening. I remember, I'm 17 or 18 years older than you are, and as a result, I started getting Variety that very season. My first copy of Variety was literally the first week of June in 1963, and by July or August, I was reading that this new group was coming over called the Beatles. And they were going to come out with a song called I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I thought, they will never go over, because everybody I know, all my teenage friends and me, did not want to hold hands. We wanted to hold other things on people's bodies, you know. So I said, they are not going to be successful. Well, I have a feeling they might not have been as large. I'm not saying the Beatles were not good. I'm not saying that, even though I sometimes have issue with some of their lyrics. A love like ours could never die. As long as I have you near me, what does that mean? If you go away for the weekend, I'm going to find somebody else. I mean, you know, and I love her. Well, anyway, but I think the Beatles would have had a tough time of it if Kennedy had not been assassinated 12 days before I Want to Hold Your Hand was issued in this country.
Wow.
We needed something fast, real fast. And as a result, this came about. It was exotic. The fact that they came from England, I think, was interesting as well, because see, my generation, the baby boomers, I'm really the first of the baby boomers. I was born literally 9 months after World War II ended. And by 1963-64, we're working. We're living at home, and we're working, and we got money. And as a result, we don't have to beg our parents anymore for 89 cents to buy little 45 RPM records.
Right.
We can now afford to buy albums for $3.98 or $4.98 or $5.98, whatever they are. And because we had that power to buy, that changed everything. Ironically enough, in the summer of 64, the number one album in this country was the cast album of Hello, Dolly. The number two album in this country was Funny Girl. And what's really astonishing to me, when I was doing research for this book, I found out that Billboard did a survey in 1983, talking about the January of 83, and they were looking back at 20 years of original cast albums, and they discovered they want to show which ones sold the most. And it's amazing to see shows like Mr. President, All American, The Girl Who Came to Supper, 110 in the Shade on the top 20, because they were selling then. 17 of them came from the 60s.
Wow.
Two of them came from the 70s, and what's interesting is they were Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell. which were not conventional musicals, and the only one from the 80s was Dreamgirls. And of course, to be fair, I mean, there hadn't been that much of the 80s yet by 1983,
right.
But still,
right.
The fact remains that the heyday was definitely before the Beatles came over to this country. And while there were still enough adults buying cast albums in the summer of 64, that was really the end of it. The next time there was an original cast album that was number one was Hair, which sounded nothing like any of the cast albums
right.
that we had had. And more to the point, it certainly appealed to us baby boomers because, of course, it was very adventurous, especially with its language.
Yeah.
There was a lot made of the fact that this was the unexpurgated cast album. You know, so if Hair were a conventional Broadway musical, it wouldn't have reached number one. But that was really the sea change. And I also think I've always had this theory that one of the reasons the guitar has had such a stranglehold on music for the last 50 years has a lot to do with television. And here's what I mean. You know, when there was radio, it didn't matter that people were playing the piano. You didn't see them. When they did movies, musical movies, and there was a guy at the piano, there was a close-up of him. He'd turn around and look at the camera, and that was fine. But when you think of it, the guitar, you can look at your audience while you are playing. It's a very telegenic instrument. And I think that's another reason. Television was becoming more and more popular. I mean, you know, it took a while for everybody to get one, you know, but when you think of it, TV had only been around 14, 15 years at that point, which historically speaking is not a long time.
Yeah.
So as a result, you know, little by little, these things were changing and happening. And don't forget, going back to the Kennedy thing, he was a big fan of Broadway musicals. He
right.
used to go all the time, you know, and so it was the thing to do. It was considered an upper middle class activity or even a high class activity, and people wanted to do it because the president was doing it. There's a very famous picture of him coming out of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying with Jackie, and this caption is, "He needs a lesson." You know, in other words,
yeah.
he knew how to succeed in business, you know. So anyway, you know, it was very common to see him be involved with Broadway musicals. And need I say more that after the assassination, we learned about the Camelot thing, and that became
right.
the idiom for the Kennedy presidency. I mean, is there any greater proof that he had an affinity for Broadway musicals than having his whole administration refer to the title of a musical? I mean, really,
right.
has that ever happened with any other president? I haven't heard if it has. You know, so as a result, suddenly we needed something new. We, of course, every generation wants to forge its own entertainment. They all want to look down on what came before. There's never been a generation that hasn't. And as a result, suddenly, the Broadway musical became quite unpopular as time would go on. Somebody was mentioning the other day, I hear this a lot. Your book is very much like William Goldman's The Season, which deals with the 1967-68 season. No, it's not. And by the way, nobody loves The Season. The Goldman book more than I.
It's a
you know,
great
I'm just,
book.
Oh, there's not one word you can say from it. I won't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I doubt I've read any book any more times than that. So this is not a criticism, but the difference is he was talking about a season when the Broadway musical was truly in trouble. In fact, that season did not produce a Tony-winning musical. Yes, yes, they gave out the prize. They gave it to Hallelujah Baby, which opened 2 months before. But the Tony cutoff in those days used to be April, while seasons technically start in June. So nothing between June 1st, 1967, and May 31st, 1968, which is really when you define seasons, June to May, no show that opened in that period of time, and there were a bunch of them, won the Tony Award. They had to go to something that opened a little after April 15th, April 25th to be specific, to
wow.
give the Tony Award. So he was talking about a season where there was trouble. So he has much more of a dramatic story to tell than I do, because mine is a celebration of a year when it was really, really good. I mean, the stars that we had that season were just amazing. And whenever I give the list, and believe me, Scott, I am not reading this from a paper. I'm just going to do this offhand. You know, Barbra Streisand, Carol Burnett, Carol Channing, Robert Preston, Mary Martin, Florence Henderson, Jose Ferrer, Angela Lansbury, Tammy Grimes, Beatrice Lilly, Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, Alec Guinness, Richard Burton, Albert Finney, Claudette Colbert, Charles Boyer, Julie Harris, Colleen Dewhurst. Look how long it took me to get to Helen Hayes, the first lady of the American theater.
Wow.
She was there too. Burt Lahr. And believe me, Robert Redford, Hal Holbrook, Jason Robards Jr., Faye Dunaway. They were all there that year and more too, believe me. I've only scratched the surface.
Wow.
So, I mean, it really was a tremendous year. And what was really good was the fact that these people, for the most part, aside from Burton, aside from Newman and Woodward, all signed contracts for at least 1 year, many times 2 years,
wow,
and quite often run of the play. You
yeah,
know,
that doesn't
and today,
happen anymore.
Of course, exactly. The movie stars who come to us now come to us for a few months figuring, okay, I'll get my T of my EGOT, my Tony, and I'll go home and I won't have to appear on Broadway ever again, and I can get the award. So they come in for a few months, and that's the end of it. But
yeah,
really, even Streisand honored her contract and stayed a year with Funny Girl and only missed one performance during that entire time. So it really was a very different time and mindset. People didn't miss performances. Today, of course, kids call in sick when they got a paper cut. But back then, it was really a badge of honor, a badge of honor to show up at the show every night, whether you felt good, bad, or indifferent.
Right. Right. Well, so let me ask you, so we've talked kind of about the cultural forces that kind of got us to that moment. Talk about musical theater as the art form. What was happening with that? Because I feel like we were kind of at the end of some things, kind of at the beginning of some things.
No question. I mean, for one thing, Dolly opened in 64, got rave reviews, the famous quotation from Walter Kerr, "Don't bother holding on to your hat, you'll only be throwing it in the air anyway." Dolly went on to run longer than any other musical had at that time. Now, of course, it's 2,844 performances, looks pretty woebegone next to
yeah,
the other, like Phantom has run more than four times as long. Mm. But, you know, the thing is that because it ran that long, many people have said, you know, it's funny, when it opened, it was state of the art. When it closed 6 years later, it looked like Blossom Time. You know, it seemed like an operetta. You know,
right,
because so much had changed in music, and of course, kids made that happen. But back then, there was certainly an emphasis on shows that had characters you could care for and had optimism. When you think of it, most of the musicals we had up until that time had so much optimism in them.
Yeah.
Put on a happy face. You got to have heart.
Right.
You got to have a dream. If you don't have a dream, how are you going to have a dream come true? All those musicals really did have those types of anthems in them, or at least peppy songs that indicated that things were great and the world should be great. And certainly on the musical stage, it was optimistic. Well, again, after the Kennedy assassination, things got pretty dire. Certainly we were in Vietnam, and is it a time to be singing Put on a Happy Face? No, it certainly isn't. You know, so the world got very complicated as the time went on. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, in the 40s, I mean, you know, there was a war, right? I mean, yeah, but that was one where everybody seemed to be pulling together. We were attacked,
right. Right.
And as a result, you know, every American felt we had to do what we had to do. But the Vietnam
right,
War, of course, polarized the country.
And all those shows in the 40s seemed to be very, isn't America awesome?
You bet. You bet. And suddenly a lot of people weren't thinking that we were, that we
right,
had no business being where we were going. And, of course, music reflects the times, you know, and as a result, one of the reasons we have so much ugly music today, I'm not talking about Broadway, because we're angry. These
yeah,
are tough times, you know,
yep,
and as a result, it's not the time for put on a happy face. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous to really do it. So under those circumstances, that's why there were so many problems with the Broadway musical once the tone of the country changed, because it wasn't long after that we had, after the assassination, we had the Vietnam War, we had another assassination and another assassination
yeah,
with the other Kennedy and with Martin Luther King, and then Watergate comes. I mean, these are not times when it's really time to sing. So that's one of the reasons why it got so bad.
And all musicals got ironic.
Yeah, oh, that happens too. Yeah, no question about that. And, you know, now it's become sort of chic to do the ironic type of musicals where we say, oh, isn't that silly, you know,
yeah,
that they're singing, you know, that type
yeah,
of thing, which is really very
I hate
sad.
That.
You brought up a good point in one of your books when you talked about Tom Hanks being on a TV show and saying, you know, it's just so artificial when they burst into song. And you said, yeah, you've been in a movie big where you become about an adult overnight, and you were in that other movie with the mermaid, you know, I mean, whatever that movie was. You know, I mean, you know, you brought that up. I remember that vividly from one of your books, you know, and it's a very good point. You know, why do they get a pass in fantasy while we don't? You know, but the point is, I also think, you know, and I hate to say this because I like both shows immeasurably, and that is The Rocky Horror Show and Little Shop of Horrors, I think ultimately were responsible for the type of thing we have now in making the So Bad It's Good musical. And I think that they were terrific shows. I know, me too. But anyway, the point is that those have, you know, engendered Evil Dead and, you know, other terrible shows that where the talent was not in evidence that you found in those other two shows I mentioned. So well, I think that's been a problem, too. Now people go to musicals to laugh at them, you know, as opposed to laugh with them, which we used to do.
Oh, and that just makes me so angry. Let's jump to the present for a moment. Talk about what those kind of shows, Evil Dead and Gutenberg and et cetera, what, why do you think they do so well? Is it just the fun of subversion, or what is it?
I think people feel superior to them. You know, we can go and say, gee, we're smarter than this. I think that's a part of it. Why do people like Dumb and Dumber in movies, you know, that type of thing? Those because we need to feel superior. We feel so beaten down in the world. There are so many people in the world who get the jobs we don't that we want. There are so many people in the world who succeed in ways that we don't because we're all in competition. I don't mean that maliciously, but we happen to be, you know, I mean, you know, so you used to go for a job interview, whatever it was, I guarantee you, since 40 million people have been added to the United States since 1980, there's more competition. So as a result, the thing is that we're all so beaten down that we need to feel superior to somebody, and we get it through our entertainment now. That's what we do. We go and we laugh at other people because that makes us feel good. What else does? I mean, you know, go on.
I feel like that aren't musicals stupid mindset has also seeped into the musicals that aren't only that, like Book of Mormon, or even Something Rotten, which I really loved a lot,
everybody I know who has a brain in his head likes Something Rotten quite a bit. You know? And I will say that I saw a workshop last year. Kevin McCollum, the producer, invited me to a workshop, and I knew it was a spectacular winner then. I'm very sorry they didn't get the review from the Times they needed, because I think that's the difference between success and, well, sellout success and, you know, 80-90%, which is what they've been doing. Right. But every human being I know who understands anything about musicals thinks it's terrific, and I'm glad to hear you weigh in on that, too.
But that's good. But do you agree that creepy mindset has gone into what seem like more mainstream musicals?
No question, aren't
musicals stupid?
Yes, however, in Something Rotten, the reason it works for me in Something Rotten is because here's the soothsayer looking into the future. And therefore, and he's the type of guy who only gets bits and pieces of information.
Right.
He's fuzzy, you know, he can't get everything clearly. And as a result, because he's doing bits and pieces, I think that famous number that sold a lot of tickets after the Tony Awards, I should point out, a musical with all these other shows referenced, is really something that is valid, because if you went to a soothsayer and that's what he saw in the future, that's what he saw in the future, you know. So as a result, it's not there's more of a reason for it. You know, I was starting to make I was doing a column for Masterworks Broadway and talking about the great list songs. Okay, and you know, I'm Still Here is certainly a great list song.
Yeah.
You Are the Top is certainly a great list song. But you know which one I think is the best of them all? Dead End from Hair. You know why? Because it's not just a list. It tells it. When you listen to the song, you say, "My God, we really are oppressed in so many ways. Yeah. There are so many things we're not supposed to do, or they don't want us to do." The other songs don't have that subtext.
Right.
You know, and as a result, that makes it a strong song to me. And, you know, so if there is more of a reason for things happening, I go with them substantially more. And as a result, that's why I applaud the number of Something Rotten for referencing musicals, where I do not in Shrek, with suddenly the princess starts singing and nobody's going to bring me down from Wicked.
Right.
You know,
right.
That doesn't belong there. You know, she doesn't know that song. That, you know, so that's the difference. And that's why I think Something Rotten works. And that moment in Shrek does not.
And I would say You're in Town works for the same reason Something Rotten does, that self-awareness comes from the story.
Absolutely true. A terrific musical, so original, and both of these shows have something else in common. They're not adapted from a damn thing. These guys had to have their own ideas, and that's what impresses me so much about both those shows, that they started with a blank piece of paper, well, I guess a blank computer screen, but you get the point, and, you know, they had to go from there. You know, I admire Fun Home, I do, but it was based on a graphic novel. I admire An American in Paris to some degree, but it's based on a movie. I admire The Visit, but it's based on a play. Something Rotten started from nothing, and that's why I think it's the greatest achievement of those four.
Yeah. All right, well, so I want to talk about some of your other books. You've written such fun books. I think I once told you that your books are like musical theater candy for me. I just devour them, and I never want to put them down. I think one of my favorites so far has been your book about the biggest hit and the biggest flop of each season, which was so much fun to read about. Talk a little bit about, you know, what started that project and what it was like to go through that history.
It's funny. I am now going to move to my point in the apartment. I am right now exactly where I was when I thought of that idea. I mean, I remember it so vividly, thinking, what a great idea to contrast the biggest and the worst, you know. And it struck me as just such a fun thing to do. I really
and a lot of the flops are wonderful shows.
Absolutely. Yeah. No question about that. For example, Lolita, My Love, is a phenomenal musical. Everything is done correctly in that musical. If you listen to the sound system bootleg, which is really very effective, you really see how skillful it is. However, you can't expect the public to go to a musical about Lolita. That was their only mistake. Doing it, especially when you listen to that sound system tape, and the girl sounds like Annie. I mean, she's too young sounding. I mean, you know, at least Sue Lyon in that famous 62 movie, you know, was a babe, you know, but this, she really sounds like her voice is of a 7-year-old. But it's a great show if you can take it, you know, but you can't expect 8 audiences a week to come, you know, over 1,000 people and say, yeah, that was great. I mean, it's just too creepy an idea. But indeed, it's a great, great musical. They really did their work. They being Alan J. Lerner, book and lyrics, and John Barry, a wonderful composer, mostly known for film work, but did terrific work on this show as well.
Didn't Barry write
Didn't
Barry write the Bond theme?
Yeah. And he also wrote a wonderful 1965 British musical called Passion Flower Hotel. Do you know that one?
I don't.
Oh, it's really good.
That's cool.
The next time I see you, I'll bring you a copy.
Right on.
You know, so this will entice you to look me up when you're in New York.
Absolutely.
So as long as I have all these things, you know, I'll never be lonely. But anyway, it will be it's a terrific score. Very 60s, very James Bond sounding. But really very good. It's about girls, little girls. Speaking of Lolita, it's interesting, this theme. It's about teenage girls who decide to make money by starting their own little whorehouse. And, you know, but they are teens, you know. And so John Barry obviously had interest in this area, you know, to, you know, it never occurred to me before until I just brought this up. But those are two musicals with very active prepubescence, you know. So, and in Passion Flower Hotel, they don't need a Humbert to entice them into anything. They're interested. They're into it, you know. And so it's great score. It really is.
That's cool. All right. Well, so the book that isn't really of all that much value to me, but I think it is to a whole lot of other people, is
Let's Put on a Musical.
Right, which is this amazing encyclopedia of musicals in terms of producing them for schools, community theaters, and so forth. It talks about cast, it talks about the plot, talks about all the requirements of the shows. You really get a sense of, can I produce this show, from reading through this book? And I just think that's so cool.
Well, ironically enough, last week I was in Lincoln, Nebraska for a week. There's a marvelous festival there every year for high schoolers. It's called the Thespian Festival, and I don't know if you know there are thespian troops all around the country. And representatives from 42 states and two foreign countries came. Some of them produced shows. Some of them just came to watch. But there were productions of Big Fish, White Christmas, Xanadu, Little Mermaid, and a new musical called Hello, My Baby, which is a jukebox musical of old songs from 100 years ago put into a plot. And it's pretty good. But anyway, my point is, you know, we all have name tags. And people meeting me was like, oh, my God, you wrote Let's Put on a Musical because they're all high school teachers. Nobody knew about any of the others, you know, I mean, but they knew about that one because, oh, that book has helped me so much, you know, so on and so forth. And it was really, oh, you got to update it, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's been updated once, ironically enough, but it's a little too soon to do it again. But I think there may be very well a third edition in the future. And I'm delighted that, you see, we're also in an era where so many people are conscripted to do drama club or say, look, if nobody else is going to do it, I'll do it. And that's what I met a lot of people who are really learning on the job, you know, they didn't study this in school. They just have the best of intentions. And sometimes it really works out wonderfully. There's a guy in Westfield, New Jersey. I do this column for MTI and I look for shows that they license. And I saw that this high school was doing Anyone Can Whistle. So
nice.
I went out there, and I'm telling you, man, it was extraordinary. I remember some years ago when Anyone Can Whistle was being done off Broadway, and I said to them, are you going to have a rock that spouts water? And the guy looks at me and says, of course not. You know, so they had confetti represent the water. This high school had the rock with water, I'll tell you that.
We had the rock when we did it.
Good for you. You should. Anyway, and it was amazing because the voices were so terrific and much better than the ones on the original cast album. And the orchestra, and I mean orchestra, sounded exactly like the cast album. So it was amazing to hear the exact same orchestrations and sounds that you hear in the cast albums, but hear better voices doing it. You know. So anyway, I went back. I had to go back at intermission. I said, find me the director. I have to talk to this director. I mean, I couldn't even wait till the end of the show. And as it turns out, he's a guy who's had no real training in the conventional educational sense of the word.
Right.
But the thing was, nobody was doing it. And kids wanted to be in shows. And okay, then I'll do it. And he's really applied himself. There's also a guy named Lou Volpe who had a book written about him called Drama High. Same story.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all right. No background, but learned and became a legend. And in fact, when MTI got Les Miserables Jr., when they wanted to try it out, they called up Lou Volpe and said, we want you to do it, because they knew he did quality work. And again, you know, don't look for diplomas in his bathroom hanging there saying that he graduated from Yale or Tulane or wherever. No, you know, wherever he graduated didn't have a drama program that he was in, I'll tell you. So it's really quite impressive how many of these people are really learning on the job. And that's why they tell me Let's Put on a Musical is good for them because, you know, many of them don't know The Girl Who Came to Supper from The Man Who Came to Dinner. You know, they're learning, you know, but they learn. And because they have the devotion and the passion, and they want the kids to have a good time. And it's so wonderful. Again, teachers are so valuable. They really are. We are all so much in their debt, and it's a shame they're not appreciated, you know, much more than they are. As Lenny Bruce used to say, Zsa Zsa Gabor gets $5,000 a week in Las Vegas, and these people make $5,000 a year. You know, so it's true.
Yeah, one of the things that I always enjoy reading your columns is that while you see pretty much everything that goes on in New York, you also see a lot of regional stuff and schools and community theaters, and I just think that's so cool that you're seeing all that other stuff.
Well, as you know, I've left a paper trail saying that the most valuable thing I have ever seen out of town was Scott Miller's production of The Nervous Set. I have said that.
Oh,
you know I have.
That's so
you
nice.
Know, there has never been a trip I've made in the world, and I've made them around the world. I've seen theater in 14 different countries and 43 states.
Wow.
But the one seeing The Nervous Set is the one I cherish the most. So, yes, I mean, if I see something's being done, I certainly go. There was a musical in 1960 called 13 Daughters, which is terrible if you've heard the album. Just excruciating. And yet, I learned too late that it was being done in Albuquerque, New Mexico, because I'm telling you, I would have gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is what I do. You know, as I always say, my mother was this old Italian lady who liked to go to everybody's wake. I like to go to everybody's show. You know, I prefer doing that. Much more fun. So, truth to tell, my mother had a good time at wakes, but anyway.
So let me ask you one last question. And I've asked a lot of people this on the podcast. Give us your assessment of where the musical theater is as an art form right now. Are we doing great? Are we doing so-so? Are we moving forward? How are we doing?
What I think is happening is we've returned to what happened 100 years ago. I think many of the shows we have today that are silly are basically princess shows, if you know that term from way back when.
Yeah.
You know, that they just meant to entertain on the basis level. And what will happen is the same evolution we've had, but it'll happen all over again. Somebody's going to stand up and say, no! Musicals can be intelligent. Musicals can move you in a dramatic way. And I think it's going to happen. I think we're going to have a type of renaissance that the 21st century is going to be the 20th century all over again. Somebody in 2043 is going to – somebody in 2027 is going to write a Showboat. Somebody in 2043 is going to write an Oklahoma. Somebody in 2056 is going to write a My Fair Lady. Somebody in 2075 is going to run a Chorus Line. You get the point. So I think that's what's happening. I think we've had to go backwards in being silly shows to going forward. You'll live to see it. I won't. But nevertheless, you'll see some very good shows as time goes on.
Well, and I think kind of part of what you're talking about is, to some extent, we've returned to the old school musical comedy, but we're using it differently in a lot of ways. You know, there are a lot of musical comedies now that have very serious themes underneath.
Sure.
But there's still rowdy musical comedy on the surface,
sure.
Which I think is a really cool development.
Oh, yeah. Like, for example, I mean, while I was watching the Book of Mormon, I was saying, whoa, this show is so wonderfully anti-religious. you know, it really does indicate that things manipulate, people manipulate. Josh Gad's character does something really that's not, to mix a metaphor with Mormons, kosher. And he just needs to get something done. And it doesn't matter to him that it's unethical. It doesn't matter to him that it really is bullshit. The point is... That's what religion does when it really gets in trouble. It goes for anything, you know, to make people really believe that this is the case, you know. So under those circumstances, yes, there's a sting to a lot of our so-called musical comedies. But I do think they're going to get more serious as time goes on, because I do think people are going to step up to the plate. There will be a new Sondheim. There will be a new Rodgers and Hammerstein. People will come in and renovate it in a way that you and I can't perceive at this moment in time. But it's going to be good.
And it feels to me like those young writers, particularly the more adventurous ones, couldn't have gotten a production 50 years ago. And now there are hundreds of little theaters around the country that'll put on a really crazy adult musical.
No question. And, you know, people have said for years that, of course, the Broadway musical is dying and all that. But I find it interesting. If in the 50s, somebody had said, okay, I'm going to name three things, and you tell me if these things are going to be around at the turn of the century. One, the Broadway musical. Two, drive-in movies. Three, Westerns on TV. I guess people would say, well, I guess it's going to be the Broadway musical, you know, because, you know, people aren't just going to be going to see live things. Now, there's television. Well, the Westerns disappeared, and the drive-in movie theaters disappeared, too, and yet this goes on. I'm more worried about movie theaters than I am about legitimate theaters. They seem to be drying up because people can get that experience at home, but you cannot get the experience in a live theater unless you're there. So as a result, I'm not particularly worried about the fate of live theater, especially, as you say, on a grassroots level. There are plenty of wonderful little theaters around. I'm telling you, I have no prejudice to thinking, oh, well, if it's not Broadway, it's not very good. Are you kidding? I've seen amazing things around this country. I wish that Shelley Winters could have been as good as Minnie's Boys as Carolyn Payne was in 1988 in Phoenix, Arizona, a performance I talk about endlessly.
Nice.
You know, I mean, yeah, really. I mean, I have seen miracles in community theater, which reminds me that some of the people who work in community theaters simply did not want to go through the process of auditioning every day. They wanted a paycheck on Friday. They wanted families. You know, all that fine values. This is America. You can choose what you want. But the thing is, that doesn't mean they don't have talent. And it doesn't mean they don't have ability. And I have seen time and time again people making different choices from the Broadway choices and better ones here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah. Hey, well, so are you working on a new book yet, or do you know what the next one would be?
Well, they were very blunt to me, saying that they have to see how this one does. But well, I did go out with my editor and tossed out a few ideas. One was the 50th anniversary of Cabaret, because I was I was with Cabaret early on. I invested money in the original Broadway production,
nice.
And read it when it was still called Welcome to Berlin.
Right.
And believe me, I'm going to pat myself on the back here, but it took a lot of courage to invest in Cabaret, considering the fact that its director, Harold Prince, had never had a hit as a director. the fact that Kandra Nebb, who had written the score, had had one show on Broadway before, a flop. Well, Kandra had actually had two that had flopped.
Oh, right.
And think about it. This was the year that the Apple Tree, Bauckenharnick's next show after Fiddler on the Roof, directed by the hottest director in show business, Mike Nichols, starring Barbara Harris, whom everybody loved. Okay,
yep.
That's one show. I Do with Mary Martin and Robert Preston, David Merrick producing, Gawa Champion directing. That's got to be a hit.
Yep.
And even bigger, David Merrick's other show that had to be a hit, Mary Tyler Moore, Richard Chamberlain, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Oh, no, Lightly was the actual first one. You know, Bob Merrill, who had just come off Funny Girl. Abe Burrows, who had recently done How to Succeed in Business and was still revered for Guys and Dolls. I mean, how could these miss? And the thing was, we were facing that. The fact that there were three shows that had to be smash hits, and what room would there be for this Welcome to Berlin musical? And as it turned out, Cabaret wound up running longer than all three of those others combined. You know, so I wanted to do that, and they said, nah, we're not going to be able to get it out by 2016. I'm still going to convince them, what's the difference? Inside the flap, you can say, for more than 50 years, Cabaret, blah,
right.
blah, blah.
Right.
You know, but anyway, so, but they shot down that idea. But it was funny, we started just talking, and I said, have you ever noticed that so many of Sondheim shows really are different versions of the Hammerstein shows? I mean, you know, Allegro, Merrily We Roll Along. They're very similar in many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Sondheim did an Asian musical as well as did Hammerstein.
Wow.
You know,
Into
the Woods, Cinderella. You know, I mean, there are all sorts. And he says, that's your next book. But frankly, they're waiting to see how this one does before they give me a contract. But anyway, Oscar and Steve, I've done a 22-page proposal on it, and we'll see how that plays out. But that might
that's
be the next
one. That's a neat idea. That would be so
well, especially, you know, frankly, Scott, I'll send you what I have so you can read it over, and you'll see that
cool.
It's amazing how many parallels there are. And also, you know, there are two expressions I want to mention here. One, there was a book that came out years ago called Father, and above the title it said, he was once the most important man in your life. He still is. And so that's part of what this book would be about as well, that Sondheim was so influenced by Hammerstein.
Right.
And yet, there's a very famous expression, a boy does not become a man until he can beat up his father. And that's what Sondheim did too.
Yep.
You know, I mean, not only but also.
Yep.
Yes, he was influenced by Hammerstein, but God knows he had to go off on his own and
right.
be his own person and write in the way that was right for him. But still, it's interesting. There are still ties to those original Hammerstein properties. It's very interesting.
Well, and I tell you, hearing you describe it, it sounds like the classic hero myth.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That Sondheim had to go off on his own and find
yeah.
his own wisdom. And
Sure. So I understand. Good.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been so much fun.
Thank you for joining us. This is Scott Miller. Now you, too, have achieved stage grok. See you next time.